Welcome to Real Talk. I'm Faisal Carmelli. Today we have Kevin Wilhelm. Kevin is the co-founder and president of Pod Marketing. I wanted Kevin to come on the show because he's going to talk to you about why marketing and advertising is important to your business. Now stay tuned to the end of the episode. Kevin is going to also give you his best pieces of advice for business owners looking to grow their business. Let's get started.
It's all about the stories of the businesses and the people involved.
That's why we're here.
No entrepreneur does it by themselves. So Kevin, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
We've been working together, I'd say almost 10 years.
Long time.
In that time, you've explained to me and tried to educate me about how you can get your message out to the market, how you can get your brand out, how you can actually grow your business. And it has done a great job in my business, and you've been working with so many. But what we don't know is, how the heck did you get into this business? So walk me through, how did Kevin start Pod Marketing?
I guess it started, you know, I grew up in an entrepreneurial family, sales primarily, but we own family restaurants, we own catering companies, things like that. And so it's always sort of been in my bones. I was told, go to university and you'll walk out with a very well-paying job. That was the what was told to me. So I think leaving university in those job interviews, I asked for what I thought, what I was always told. And reality hit.
Okay.
And so for me to hit sort of the income level I wanted, but also the passion that I wanted, I started selling advertising and media to small businesses. So I worked with the Yellow Pages group originally at a university and really learned and understood the small business medium, the marketing for them, and really helping to grow their business. From there, I moved on and ran the marketing for a publicly traded childcare company called, now it's called BrightPath, mm-hmm. Early Learning. They are the largest across Canada. And in that time, I was introduced to a gentleman by the name of Bruce Sittler, who is the owner of Action Furnace.
Okay.
So many people would know them here in Calgary. And we kind of got paired up to do some consulting work and to help him really grow his business. We had met through a mutual friend. And at the time, we really enjoyed the conversations that we had together. And we found that we could connect on a level of how to market, how to advertise, how to differentiate yourself. And we really clicked. And at that point, a conversation sort of brewed. And we said, what if we did this together as an agency? And originally, we had said I was going to get some friends together. He was going to get some friends together, and they were going to pay for our kind of team and sort of help subsidize the cost of the agency.
Sure.
And really just focus in on home service marketing.
Yeah.
The deal we sort of made is, let's do that, but let's not stop there. Let's think bigger and more global. And so that was the plan. I was going to quit my job and start with him as my only client. And we knew out of the gates, and this is just more the salesman in me, you need a different story to tell in order to sit at the table and win sort of those relationships. And so we either had to be geographically focused, so Calgary's best agency, we had to be product focused, so the best website company or lead gen company, or the third one was industry focused. And so that's really where we chose to go, was focus on an industry, solve the problems, identify the opportunities, and then sort of build that on scale and help companies in that industry. So originally we launched home services was our first. Action Furnace was our first client. We did electrical and plumbing and roofing, and we sort of grew that portfolio. And that's how we originally started the company.
What would you say was the one thing that separates you from the competition? Because when you sat down with your partner, you had to not only think of the industry you wanted to work in, mm-hmm. you had to kind of say, we're going to be different or better than the rest in some format. What was that?
So it's really two things. One is we wanted to be very scientifically approached. So knowing data, knowing the numbers, understanding the insights of what analytics showed. And our tagline really is the science of marketing and the power of collaboration and collaborating with our clients. And so that was what we went to market with originally. It's understanding their industry, understanding digital marketing, and understanding the profitability of different products and services within the business. We could sort of create a profitable equation for any business when it comes to their marketing, and we could generate a really good ROI. It has since evolved to also now incorporating a new format in the industries that we specialize in, which is a membership model. An example being optometrists. We have about 200 optometrists we work with across North America. So when an optometrist works with us, they get a website that we have really formulated and have a very systematic approach to how we build that to be successful out of the gates. But we also provide them a social media library, a video library, all of these assets that are specific to their industry. And so they're getting value out of the gates because we have all of this content created for them specifically. And so we're now building these membership models in the industries that we're servicing. So it's been that approach. And then of course, the last one would be the team approach and not outsourcing anything, really trying to build up all of those core processes and expertise in-house. And so when you work with a team at Pod, you're working with a team that's all in one room, they collaborate, they work together, and all that expertise is really centered together.
Why did you choose it that way? Why not subcontract to other freelancers and so forth? Because you've got a whole big talent pool in the world today.
Yeah.
Why keep them all in-house on your team?
When I started the business, I looked, because I sat in the client seat, and I also sat in the selling advertising seat. So I'd had the privilege of being able to understand both worlds. And I looked at all of the objections that I had heard over the years. And one of them was, you know, I'm buying you, you know, as a salesperson, but I don't know who's doing the work. And they don't know me, they don't know my business, they don't understand it. Mm-hmm. And so from out of the gates, we felt that we had a competitive advantage if we could get our team in the same room, building towards the same goal, and then being able to get on a phone with a client all together. So this was well before the world has kind of forcibly gone digital in the last 6 months. This was, you know, 5-6 years ago, where people were outsourcing all over and our team was all together, and it allowed us to move quickly and do a lot more within an agency hour than typical agencies could do because we were all together and we were talking and collaborating in a close-knit group.
How many members do you have on your team today?
I would say right now we are over 40. We are hiring for 4 new positions this month.
Your industry has a reputation of people coming in and leaving the business.
Yeah.
Or a company.
Yeah.
Today you're dealing with so-and-so and that person's gone in 6 months mm-hmm. for whatever reason it may be. How challenging is that as a business owner to kind of in the middle of your stomach feel that, will this person be here in 6 months because they might find a different opportunity or it's not their calling or whatever it may be. I find that in the industry that you're in, people come and go quite quickly. So how do you deal with something like that?
Yeah, a lot of times, especially when you're in the service business, you're buying people. You're buying their ideas, their strategies, their experience. And so, you know, we look for very talented people that can come and contribute to client success, team success. And then what we're really focusing on is almost processifying that in a way of how do we take what we know about your business, document it, understand what have we tried, what hasn't worked, what has worked, put that into a software. And so anybody new joining your account in our team, whether it's a graphic designer, we have videos created about your brand that we've created. So anybody walking in new can get caught up really fast. They can look through the notes. They can look through previous meeting notes. We can look at all the reporting we've done over, you know, 5 years together and say, where are we at? And sometimes fresh eyes are great. Sometimes the strategy is you should be bringing in new people because you're dealing with people. Their strategies are going to get so far. And so sometimes we do want to bring in new people just to accelerate. I think the frustration that business owners feel is here I go again. Mm-hmm. I'm having to explain who I am and what I do. And we're going to start from scratch. And I think being able to build the continuity and already planning to know that, and it may not even be an opportunity outside the business. For us, we promote and we grow within many times. Yeah. And so you don't want to discourage employees from having new opportunities in-house and growing, but we want to ensure a great client experience. And so planning that continuity out of the gates, to me, is a great strategy with clients.
What's been harder, hiring or firing?
I love hiring.
Yeah.
In the beginning, that was hard because we had an idea. I was trying to recruit really talented people from top agencies. And I had no clients, no reputation. So in the beginning, that was harder, but by far more fun. Now, letting people go at any point is always the hardest thing.
Yeah.
We have been fortunate enough that even through COVID, we got through without downsizing our team, without letting anybody go. Mm-hmm. So anybody that does exit the business should know well ahead that this was coming. This was a plan together. For us, we actually have a matrix that we use, and it's high culture and performance. And so on the bottom where you're low culture and low performance, they typically don't make it out of probation. They're sort of self-governed and self-policed out. They understand in a week or two, this isn't the right fit. And then you have the high performers, low culture. I have very, very little time for them. They're the ones that will tell you that your business can't run without you. I refer to them as the chips in a windshield that just cause the cracks long term. And so those are ones that, you know, you take a long time to hire, fire quickly. Those are those kind of people. On the other side of the spectrum, we have the high culture people. So if you are a high culture but low performer, we will do everything we can to put together a plan to get you there. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, our high performer, high culture, those are where we call them unicorns. Yeah. We actively look for them and keep them. And if we're doing our job, those people should be cycling through those two buckets. So they should be a high performer until they're given new responsibility, new accountabilities. And then they should come down into low perform because it's a new job, new role.
Sure.
And then they're learning. And then as they go up, and so as management, our job is to keep them going in that cycle. Mm-hmm. Their job is to keep forcing themselves up in that high performance bucket as well. So
very similar, because I talk about skill and will. Mm-hmm. You can teach skill, but you can't teach the will to do it. So when you come across with an employee who doesn't have that culture or the will to do it, how do you handle that?
They very rarely make it through the interview process. I will say that when we get to an interview stage, we have identified that you can do the work. An interview for us is purely culture-based. Like, we get the numbers out of the way, we get the job description, all that's done in like a phone interview, 15 minutes, the resume, all that should be taken care of. Then we really come down to, what will you do when you're here? Who will you be? How will you contribute to the team, the product, the company? And our hiring philosophy has always been, rather than hire people that have proven success in the past, I want to hire people that have the attributes to be great tomorrow. And so when you look at a development curve, people that have already done the job and they're looking at this as almost like a lateral move, their growth kind of goes slow and steady into the right, you hope. With somebody that looks at an opportunity like, just give me a chance.
Yeah.
I've been just waiting for an opportunity, and their development curve, they have to take a lot of that on themselves. They come in, their initiative's high, their teamwork's high, positivity is high, and they come out of the gate sort of swinging. What we find is that their development curve is now really steady and high to the right. And then once they reach that level that they're competent in the job, they're now on a different trajectory that takes them well past. And so our interviews are always, can you do the job tomorrow? What do you want to do in 2 or 3 years? And is this somebody that we want to have at the table as part of this company for a long time? So that's really our interview process, rather than just the, can you do the job?
Is that a scientific way of hiring, or is that a emotive way of hiring?
Definitely not scientific. Okay. We had to become more scientific. So early on, I did all the hiring and I didn't bring an interview guide. It was just always a conversation. Mm-hmm. And the conversation went to where it went to. And I kind of used to hire on gut feeling. As we grew and had to elevate and delegate other responsibilities and have other people hire, we realized we needed a more consistent approach. So then we started bringing in interview guides and we started really creating a process for hiring. Then we said, okay, the questions need to be culture-based. They need to be on the fit. But there still is that gut feeling of, do I want to work with this person for the next 3 to 5 years?
So if the science says, check mark, this person's a good fit,
yep,
you still go back to the gut feeling and go, maybe not?
You can tell in an interview, you look for the red flags. And there are a few questions that I will always ask that are my live and die type of questions.
You got to open that up now. Sure. Tell me what the red flags are.
One of them is, I will always ask, what are you looking for in a job? And everybody will always say work-life balance. Mm-hmm. Everybody says it now. Mm-hmm. My next question is, what does that mean to you? And what I'm looking for is someone that more or less says they're looking for a career that is part of their life. And especially in the world we are now, you can kind of work from anywhere. So they wake up and they're thinking about, how can I be a better person tomorrow? How can I be a better employee tomorrow? They don't define work as 9 to 5. When they answer the question, work-life balance means at 5 o'clock, my phone goes off and I don't think about work till tomorrow. They've already established what they won't, what they're not willing to do. What I'm looking for is someone who's so passionate about doing great work that they're looking at incorporating it into their life. And like, we do not have a stringent work policy in terms of hours. We are a get your 40 hours in, however it comes to you, however you need to, by Monday to Sunday night. But I'm looking for people that early on define what they will and won't do. And that to me is a red flag. because I want people that, again, say, this is my opportunity. Give me the platform to be great at something. Mm-hmm. And the questions that they're asking are, what is the vision? What is the dream? What am I buying into? What am I going to dedicate the next 3 to 5 years of my life in? So if I don't see those questions coming out, then I find you're probably sitting in a seat that's meant for somebody else.
Okay.
And the other one is the biggest issue between manager and employee is the inability to give and receive feedback. And so in the interview process, give them some sort of constructive criticism and watch how they react. And if you can see that they slouch or they shy away or they don't stand up to it, you can pretty much guess that in the future they're going to have that problem, especially with creative people. And I work with a lot of creative people, and they have to understand the clients sometimes are what they want is what's right and not just what you've created. So that's the other thing I look for is how well they take criticism.
You have a lot of millennials working for you.
Yeah, very much.
And there's been a lot of negative views of millennials as employees.
Yeah.
A lot of it I don't believe.
Yeah.
I think you and I have had conversations in the past about the stigma is not true.
Yeah.
Walk me through how you work with a millennial to get the optimal performance out of them.
Yeah, so I personally believe that if a person, but we'll go millennial, is properly motivated and they are given the platform to do something meaningful, you will get more out of them than almost any generation you're going to see. And millennials today want to be part of something great. They want to be something bigger than of themselves. And understanding how their role plays in the success of the company will always dictate success. So even using someone as like a office admin or somebody answering phones, that is the first impression that a potential client may have mm-hmm. with your entire organization. Mm-hmm. Setting up a meeting to make sure the meeting goes really well. That sets up the entire sort of conveyor belt of the experience that the client's going to get. So the way we look at it is, one is we ask them, where do you want to be in 3 to 5 years? Like truly, where do you want to go? Because we want to help get you there.
Yeah.
And if it's in this company or it's outside these walls, we do our best to make sure that they achieve their career goals. And we're very upfront in saying that role doesn't exist here and probably won't. But we do know other companies that have that. And I will personally call those CEOs or presidents to advocate on your behalf. So establishing a career guideline and then saying, okay, this is what we need from you in the role. This is what you need from us to support your career growth. That together is a really good combination. And then just being open and transparent about what the company stands for. We are very transparent in terms of why we make the decisions we make. We try not to put a lot of closed doors up and let people wonder. And I think by opening those doors and setting them and giving the respect of this is what you're trying to achieve in your career, that's where we build a really good partnership and we can allow them to be great.
One of the most challenging things that I hear from business owners today is that when they have their marketing budget and they put that number out and they say, it's very difficult for me to spend this money because I'm testing stuff.
Yeah.
I'm not marketing. I'm seeing if it works. How do you explain to business owners today about this concept of testing versus a proven marketing strategy that you just add some money to it and goes?
The only way it can be proven is if you test it. So let's first start there. So in the beginning, if you've never done digital marketing, it has to be a test because we've never ran it for you in this market with your message, your logo, your brand to your audience before. So we have to see how effective. We can be pretty accurate in terms of predicting how well it'll be and how much you need to spend. But at the end of the day, we don't control a lot of the variables about who answers your phone call and what is your competitive difference on your website. Is there a clear difference? So to the gates, we do have to test a lot of things. Once we see what works, that's where you can start to hone in on a proven strategy. So if we know that Google advertising and search advertising yields an 8-to-1 return, then we can pretty much earmark a portion of your budget to that with predictive results. Then we can look at Facebook, and if we're seeing a 4x ROI, okay, then we know the next portion of the budget can do that. What we as an agency need to do is always test and move. Is this message more effective than that message? Is this platform more effective than that platform? And the reason you're always testing is that user behavior, the consumers are changing rapidly. Over the COVID shutdown, Instagram usage went up significantly. Obviously, people are at home, they're on mm-hmm. social media. And so people that weren't communicating through Instagram before, Now, what an opportunity, because we know that usage has increased significantly. TikTok, where before March, while it was growing fast, it didn't really have a massive sharehold. Now, TikTok is it's hard to find someone that hasn't at least downloaded it and tried it.
Yeah.
And so now as a business owner, you know, pre-March, it wasn't really necessary. Now we have to test it. We have to try it because your audience is there. They're being influenced by businesses like you. So marketing, there always needs to be a portion of a budget or a portion of a strategy that says, we need to try new things because the world is changing, platforms are changing, competitors are coming in and out, and it changes every day. So we have to be nimble and we have to be able to be dynamic in our strategy and our budgets.
During the major part of the pandemic, I was surprised to see how many business owners didn't even have a website. Mm. I was surprised to see how many didn't have a social media presence, like just a presence. Forget about actively putting out content.
Yep.
With those individuals and those businesses in mind, how do you actually get them to go from, I was doing pretty much nothing, to you have no choice but to be in the social media space? How do you get them to buy into that kind of a program?
I think first, just realizing that that's where your customers are. Because if they're not there, where are they? Where are you going to find the new prospects, new customers, new clients for your business? You know, I told you I used to work at Yellow Pages. A book literally used to show up on your front door.
Yeah.
And you would just open it when you needed it.
Yeah.
And it really changed when cell phones became very prominent and Google became the search engine. And now it's even, you can talk to your TV and ask to buy something and Amazon can ship it within a minute. So it's changed so rapidly that just understanding that consumers are going online to do research of some sort. Even if they were referred to you by a friend, we still go online, we go to their website, we look at where are you located, what's a review, what is your return policy, what is your pricing and warranties, all of these things. And when they land on a website, so A, if you don't have one, the assumption in today's world is, oh, they're not in business anymore. So we need to have that presence. And then the next thing is when I land on your website, what is the story being told to me? What is the impression I'm getting? What's the emotional connection? At the end of the day, they're going to ask, do I want to do business with this company? Do they have the same values? Do they have the same look and feel and the appearance? Are they saying what I need them to say? All of that contributes to whether that referral actually becomes a paying customer or just becomes, oh, I referred you, but I found someone else. Because that does happen. You may be growing your business through referrals, but social media and digital marketing really solidifies those referrals because they have to go somewhere to learn more about you.
So we've got a whole bunch of business owners and entrepreneurs that are coming to me, Kevin, and they're saying, I don't know how much to put aside, what percentage of my revenue, as an example, and I don't know what to do as my next step. It, once I've determined my budget. So how do you start setting the budget with a business owner? And then what's the next step after that?
Sure. So the first one is determining your objective. Are you a business that is trying to grow or sustain? And if you're sustaining, then we really were looking at building a brand for tomorrow. If you're trying to grow, then we're looking at lead generation. So how many more customers can I see in the next week, month, you know, quarter versus I'm actually full. I can't. My resources have gone down. I can't take on more customers, but I want to be around for years from now. So I need to spend some time investing in a branding strategy. So understanding your objective as a business is the first part. So now let's go, you want to grow. We look at what did you spend last year to achieve last year's results. So if that was 3% or 4% of last year's sales, then taking everything into account the same, if you spent the same money, you should have the same results. Now I want to look at how much I want to grow. So if I'm $1 million a year business and I spent $30,000 last year on advertising, I spent 3% of my total sales and marketing. So this year I need $30,000 to maintain the million, but I want to grow 20%. So I want to go from $1 million to 1.2. That $200,000 incremental is more costly because I have to tell more people in the world that I exist.
Yeah.
And so for that, we allocate 10%. So 200,000 at 10% would be 20,000. Add that to the 30 and we're looking at $50,000. So we have X percentage to sustain and a higher percentage of incremental growth. And those are baseline numbers. If you are, if you're in a great retail location, you pay high rent, you can spend a little bit less on growth. If you are out in the middle of nowhere, a service company that goes to you, then it has to be a higher percentage. But rule of thumb, we look at what did you do last year? And then 10% of incremental growth add those together, and that should be the starting base for a marketing budget. Then what we do, that's an annual base, but we're going to break that into quarters because we need to know whether it needs to be adjusted every 3 months. The first step is building out a marketing plan that says, in the next 90 days, what do I need to achieve to hit my one-year target or my three-year vision? So establishing what does the future look like in 3 years? What do I have to be in a year from now to hit the three-year goal? And then what do I have to do in the next 90 days to get there? A lot of times, it's a updated, refreshed website. Sometimes it's we need to redo or launch our social media channels. We need to create great video content. Maybe I'm creating a podcast similar to what you're doing right now. So building out these big initiatives and doing them in three-month increments, looking at how much money you spent, determining was that initiative a lead generation, so I should be evaluating on how many leads came in and opportunities came in, or am I evaluating on brand building? And then it should be how many eyeballs, how many people saw it, what are the comments, what's the engagement like? Those types of things are important when you develop a scorecard for how effective your marketing is 90 days at a time.
Very scientific, very mathematical. Mm-hmm. Did your business evolve to bring out the science, or did you know the science before you brought out the business?
No, we've learned this through working with clients that have been open to collaborating and partnering with this model. So I told you my business partner is Bruce, the owner of Action Furnace. He is somebody that has always been willing to reinvest in his business, try new things. And so from early on, the conversations that we had, even in forming this company, were similar to this. We would ask these questions. What should the right marketing budget be? How much should I be investing? And then we try different things. And we saw that together through his business and then applying it to many others, these are the formulas that tend to resonate, that people can digest, and have worked really well for those that are open to investing and reinvesting in their business.
How important is it for the analytics of all the different types of marketing a company should do?
You can't optimize what you don't measure. And so understanding your numbers, to me, is one of the most important things a business owner can do when it comes to marketing.
What would you say is your biggest failure in this business?
Not recognizing the real opportunities that were in front of us, and probably moving, even though we've grown quickly, I believe that we have gone slower than we could have. Probably early on, the failure was trying to do too much myself, was taking on the role of so many different aspects of the business.
Yep.
And I think that when we put the right people in the right seats, that's when everything clicked for us. And so that would be, to me, the opportunity. And once I had that team for us, I think we should have been putting more gas on earlier.
So when you say an opportunity that's been lost, give me an example of an opportunity that you could have seized earlier.
Probably an acquisition strategy.
Okay.
I think in our industry, it's very fragmented, and there's an opportunity to expand through acquiring other agencies that have specializations in other products or markets or industries.
Sure.
And up until now, we have always said we need to figure out our processes, because what you don't want to do is acquire a company and realize that you're just as messed up as they are.
Okay.
And now you're trying to figure it all out. So you really have to have things documented and ready to go so that you can make 1 + 1 = 3.
Your business, just like many other businesses out there, are seeing a lot of competition online. Mm-hmm. Hire us, click here, we can do it for you at a cheap price.
Yeah.
That's happening in every industry throughout the economy. How do you compete with that?
You're right, every industry is dealing with that right now. So for us, we look at that in our marketing strategy of education, both showing up on podcasts like this and educating, speaking. I was fortunate enough to write a book last year in 2019. And so being able to educate and show that this is our approach, this is our method, this is our team that stands behind, I think that sort of uncovers the scariness of digital marketing. And part of the education is also setting the stage for clients to know what they're getting themselves into. And in order to be successful, we need you to meet us halfway as well. You know, there needs to be that collaborative approach of give us a lot of ingredients to work with so we can make a great meal, in essence.
So both of us are authors of a book.
We are.
We've had a conversation about the reasons why I wrote my book. Why did you write yours, though?
It was never part of my plan. I never set out to be an author.
Yeah.
I actually went to a conference and heard Tucker Max speak. So he's the author of I Hope They Serve Beer in Hell. Mm-hmm. And it was a 15-minute talk about why you should never write a book. And he said, if you want to be rich, you should never write a book.
Correct.
Because you'll never make money. If you want to be famous, you should never write a book. Because how many authors can you name that are famous because they're an author versus how many famous people became authors?
Correct.
So all that resonated. I'm like, yeah, absolutely. What a waste of time this talk is. And then he said, if you want to be an industry expert, if you want to get meetings that you never could get before, if you want to differentiate yourself as an entrepreneur, as a business owner, differentiate your business, be able to tell your story to your audience, then you want to write a book. And that resonated so well with me. And I said, I write e-guides, you write e-books, I write articles on LinkedIn. We are speaking, our company speaks and I speak regularly. Why not put it into a book and have it there? Because that will allow us to really become the authority, in a subject matter. Mm-hmm. You know, I dedicated hours a week, same hours every week, like every time. It was a lot of diligence and discipline to getting it out. And it's been a great experience for me.
It's called Click, Transform Your Business Through Digital Marketing. Kevin, this is fantastic. Available on Amazon.
Available on Amazon.
I would strongly recommend grabbing a copy of this book. It is fantastic. It will help you understand through Kevin's eyes how this whole transformation happens.
That's right.
So Kevin, given all of your experience, everything that you've worked with industries and individual clients and entrepreneurs, give us your top three business tips for them.
Number one, surround yourself with a great team. Business is a team sport, and an investment in the right team will always yield great results. Number two, never sit back on complacency. I think there's always a better way to do anything. And if you can optimize every piece of your business by 1% or 2%, at the course of a year, you can be exponentially ahead. And then three, because I'm in advertising and marketing, I would say strategize an effective marketing plan and allocate the appropriate budget to make sure that it has enough legs and wings to be able to get you where you want to go.
Kevin, I want to thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Faisal.
If you want more real talk and tips to help you succeed in your business, subscribe and hit the bell for all the latest updates. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.